the network for the AV industry.
What are you listening to?
This
is AV.
This is AV Nation.
This is AV Nation.
AV Week is produced and distributed through a partnership with Rave Publications and AV Nation. For more information, go to ravepubs.com/AV Nation. This is AV Week, episode 50, recorded Friday, July 20th, 2012. Magnetic Copper.
Ready.
AV Week.
Performing scan.
Brain Week.
Online.
This is AV Week. It's time for AV Week, your weekly wrap-up of audiovisual news and information. I am your host, Tim Albright. Thank you so much for joining us, for downloading this, for streaming this live on your website and or browser and or mobile device. I don't know. This week, we have two very cool, very seasoned veterans, not only of the AV industry, but also of this show. First up is George Tucker. He is the engineering coordinator of World Stage. Good afternoon to you, sir.
Good afternoon, everybody.
And also with us is an author, and I think I've officially said that I'm the dumbest guy on this call, an author and a guy who went to Yale.
He's graduate school.
Yes, still went to Yale. Professor of Entertainment Technology at the New York City College of Technology, Professor John Huntington.
Oh, thank you.
This week, we're going to talk about an awful lot of stuff, and we're kind of, you know, hit and miss here. We're going to talk about DARPA and the CIA because, you know, I haven't been audited yet by the IRS, and I'd really like to be, so. Oh, and the FBI. So, yeah, we'll hit all three of those, so I'm sure to get audited. We'll talk about RIM and a whole bunch of patent stuff. Extron and their restaurant. And, yes, I said Extron and their restaurant. And some other stuff like Steve Wozniak and whether or not you may or may not want a smaller iPad. But first, next week, the Olympics return to London for the first time in a long time. And the reason we're bringing up the Olympics is because, according to the BBC, which is, of course, you know, the public broadcaster of grand old Britain, they are going to be shooting the Olympics in 3D and HD. Now, I'm all about shooting it in HD, and we can have a conversation with John and George later about what technically is HD in 2012, whether that's 4K, 8K, or just the 1080p. I don't really have a grand opinion on that. But what I'm really concerned about is the fact that they are just really, really promoting the fact that this is the first live broadcast for the BBC in 3D, and they've got all of these true 3D cameras going around, and most of them are PTZ, you know, they're remotely manned by somebody else, but there are also, you know, other ones as well. And I'm concerned because I don't have a great affinity, let's say, for 3D. I still think it's a fad. But this almost gives credence. This gives 3D some legs to stand on, George, does it not? Or am I silly and think that this gives it, you know, legitimacy?
You know, yes and no. But then again, I mean, look, ESPN's been one of the first to roll out going 3D sports. We've got a channel dedicated to it.
They did the World Cup.
Yes, and I actually didn't see that. I haven't read any reviews of the World Cup in 3D, but it doesn't make it legitimate? Sure, if they do it right, I suppose. But, I mean, the technology is still very infantile. It's still, I mean, where are most people going to watch the Olympics? I guess at home. So it's not sort of like watching the championship playoffs or anything. So maybe more people will be likely to watch it at home than, say, at a sports bar or some big gathering. But I really haven't... Except for maybe soccer, I'm having a hard time figuring out what sports would really look exciting in 3D. I mean, I guess the gymnast doing the floor exercise coming right at you might be something, but...
The javelin throw.
There you go, the javelin throw. I didn't think of that. That's great.
What? It wasn't that funny, George. I appreciate it.
I thought it was funny. I'm having this whole vision in my head of thing coming right at you.
John, George makes a good point. If they do it right, and most people are going to watch this in their homes. And yes, there have been this influx of, you know, if you buy a new TV today, whether you want it or not, most likely it's going to have some sort of 3D ready, quote unquote, connectivity. So if they do it right, and if a lot of people have this in their homes and that's what they're watching, is it, you know, is that the way to not force it down their throats? Because I'm trying to be objective here, even though I don't like it. But
you need to be objective.
Well, yeah.
You don't need to be objective.
Well, does it give it, you know, a leg up to, I mean, I guess at what I'm trying to say is, at the end of the Olympics here, do you think that the fact that they're doing this in 3D is going to make people, is going to create this groundswell for people to say, you know, give me Doctor Who in 3D?
Well, I don't know. Do you think they're going to rush out and buy, everybody's going to buy 3D TVs in the next week? And then, you know, I think the opening ceremonies are about a week from when we're taping this.
Yeah, the 27th. So. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'm overall, I'm with you guys. I think, I don't know if it's a gimmick or whatever, but I would say that 3D to me is sort of like what rollerblading was in the 90s, where it was, you know, it's still around. There's still people doing it, but, and, you know, there's some special purpose things. People are doing roller derby and that kind of stuff, but it's not, you know, you don't see the people out that you used to 15 years ago. And I still have yet, you know, I've yet to see any 3D. I mean, I'm going back 25 years, I've been looking at this stuff, and I've yet to see one that any 3D product that wasn't like cool for 5 minutes and then just annoyed me after that. I guess I'm not the target audience.
Well, are they showing this stuff in theaters? I mean, is there any kind of live simulcast like they do for the operas?
Not that I'm aware of.
I didn't read that. One would think that's where it would be most beneficial, wouldn't it? Like, all right, see it on a large IMAX or see the finals here for something, especially if, I guess, in Britain, if your countrymen are going to go for something big and gold. But that's about the only time I could see it really, really working, except for the really hardcore aficionado. But, I mean, look, I mean, and ESPN, I guess, is no measure because, as the joke goes in the volleyball movie, they have the Ocho, the number 8.
That's yeah. Right.
They'll be there soon enough, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. And that's the thing that kind of bugs me is the fact that, you know, like John said, nobody's going to run out in the next week and buy a 3D TV simply because the BBC or NBC, if they decide to do this, in this country is, you know, is broadcasting in 3D, so.
I mean, and I really haven't looked into it that carefully, but are there any 3D distribution standards? Because it still sort of seems like a free-for-all to me. It's just like there's no clear, this is the way to do it, so I don't know. And there's still not that big of a market for it. I mean, installed. It's not that many screens to view it on.
Well, and that makes it, that you raise a really good point. Another article that we're going to post here is a article from the Wall Street Journal, titled 3 weeks with a 3D TV. And, you know, it you're right. There is no standards, and not that I'm the world's biggest standard advocate because, you know, we have so many of them. But there are certain things that would make sense to do. One would be if you're going to put something out there like 3D or, you know, I don't know, put a moniker on something like HD, let's have some standards and let's all agree on what it is, you know, whether that's, you know, this is, you know, the stereoscopic or auto stereoscopic, you know, make me sound really smart, you know, but I don't know. I just don't see it. So.
Well, here's a question about that then. Are we past the days, and this is sort of marketing business question within 3D or in general, with 3D showing this and what you just said, you know, they have it, there's no standards. Are we past the point where being the first to market is really of any value?
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, there's been 100 people first to market now, you know.
Well, there's
right, but sometimes you get a success out of that and the technology you develop becomes something else inside of others. So at least to the general public, you disappear, but really in the industry, you're still doing something. So maybe you don't sell the monitors themselves anymore, but you sell them what's inside them, right? That old ad. But it's starting to dawn on me more and more that maybe that's the case, that beyond a very specific commercial application, being the first to market in the general mass market is not really advantageous at all, and that's what we're showing here.
Well, it's not unless it hits. I mean, that's kind of the dice that you throw, isn't it? You know, if you're the first to market with, you know, I don't know, mini disc, then no. But if you're the first to market with, I almost said MP3 player, but you're right. the first to market there didn't hit either. It wasn't until Apple made, you know, the MP3 player hip. So, and the tablet for that matter.
When I think in this Wall Street Journal article, the guy says, you know, when he's in week two, when he's saying this is really exciting, he's talking about a horror movie, Fright Night 3D.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, that's another gimmick. You're going to jab a knife in somebody's face and whatever. It's like, so it's, you know, and I think everybody, I mean, I still get that occasionally if I see a 3D anything. And the first time you see it, it's like, wow, that's really cool. And then after that, it just gets tiresome to me.
Well,
and I think
No, go ahead.
I think a lot of this still goes back to, and I think I even talked about the last time I was on the show, is that Walter Murch, who's an amazing editor who did and sound guy, worked on Apocalypse Now and a lot of stuff like that. And he wrote a whole thing that ended up on Roger Ebert's blog about how the there's still this idea that your brain is converging on some screen. I'm sorry, your eyes are focusing on a screen, but your brain is converging somewhere else. And that's still like a dissonance that I think, you know, it take a long time. You know, we've evolved that way over a long period of time, and it's not going to change overnight. So I think the more effective 3D for me has been like in a big screen where you're far away from it, because then those things are kind of getting closer together. Or maybe in some VR, you know, thing where it's projected half an inch from your eye, where there's, you know, it's kind of weird anyway. But still, I just, to me, there's no, it does, I guess the core part to me is that I've yet to see an example where it enhanced the storytelling to me. And that, until it does that, I don't really care, you know. So if they, if James Cameron can't do it, you know, then who's going to be able to use it that way?
In that same article, he also though mentioned that the games, like the Xbox game, or was it the PlayStation? I can't remember which one it was at this juncture. But he said he was really impressed. And maybe now what we're seeing, did the market miss? It's all in the gaming people. And then maybe when the gaming's doing it, you guys can develop on the side and slowly roll it out rather than this big rush to make money when there was no money. Because I've heard people wax absolutely rhapsodic about the games and saying in 3D they're awesome, but they wouldn't buy a 3D TV for anything else.
It's just the games.
Yeah.
I still go back to the very best 3D experience I've ever had in my life was 20 years ago.
Right.
And that was at in Disney World. It was the Muppet movie in 3D.
Right.
And technically, it was more than 3D. Reference to another article that we have on the list this weekend that was 4D. And the reason I say 4D is because not only did you have a 3D experience with the actual movie was shot in 3D, it was produced in 3D, but you had all these other elements inside the theater happening at the same time. There's a part of that movie, which if you've never been, there's water is splashed, and there's water mist in the theater. There are other Muppets in and around the theater that are coming to life and basically enveloping you into this experience. And maybe that's what I'm missing when it comes to just a flat 3D experience. You know, yes, I can see, you know, the javelin coming at me.
That's right. If they could, the Olympics, they probably wouldn't be able to put the camera into the field because then some guy's going to have the perfect javelin shot that just goes right through the lens or something, and now his record will be invalidated or something. So it's like I've been watching the Tour de France the last 3 weeks, and the best shots would be from the motorcycle in front of the cyclist, but you never get that shot because they would be drafting on the motorcycle. So shots are always from the side or the back. So, I mean, it's always TV is still secondary to the actual sporting event.
I don't understand
Although it's been a great race, has it not, John?
Yeah, it's been. I missed it the last few days, but it's been pretty interesting.
Yeah, I've been making a point of going to NBC Sports and watching it every night because it's been dramatic. I have to say.
Yeah,
I just don't get bicycling. I'm sorry. ever since Lance Armstrong, that's been, you know, that was the extent of my cycling experience. So
well, you and most Americans, and I'm a Formula One fan too. It's the same way.
Hey, listen, there's an Englishman at the lead. He may win it for the first time, an Englishman. So it's interesting to you now. Come on. He's almost American.
Okay, I'm German and Cherokee. What part? All right. To listen to AV Week with a German Cherokee. All right. No, just joking. George Tucker and also John Huntington are here as well. One of the stories that George sent along was really cool, and it was actually everywhere. You could honestly not miss this one, and that is about the new Audi experience, or is it Audi? It's Audi, the new Audi showroom that incorporates a 210-inch HD display with a Kinect. That's right. I said a Kinect, as in an Xbox. This sucker's freaking cool. John, a couple of AV guys have actually put this on their blogs, talking about how we may not see showrooms anymore with actual physical product, where, you know, you've got this giant display and you can interact with it and everything, and kind of build your own car, you know, your own Audi, or build your own system. Is this kind of where we're going with this sucker, with this giant Kinect system? And there's also a multi-touch display in there as well, where you don't have to physically have a showroom full of cars, or you don't have to have a showroom full of equipment or gear. You just walk somebody into this almost holodeck-like room and say, here, knock yourself out, build yourself a car.
Yeah, I'm actually, right, I was just Googling. I think the Audi is owned by Volkswagen, right?
I think so, yeah.
And they, for I don't even know how many years, but at least 15 years, I would say, at least 10, they've had this thing in Europe at the Wolfsburg factory called the Autostadt. And the basic idea of that is sort of the predecessor to this thing, just a little less high tech, where you would order up you go to your local dealer in Germany or Belgium or wherever it is, and then you'd order up the car you want, and then you would take the train to the factory, and they had a theme park and a little pretty amazing thing, like your completed car sitting in this circular kind of silo building.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
Then I've been there. I don't know. It must have been 7-8 years ago, because a friend of mine did all the control stuff for this. And this little silo building, a little robot goes up and picks your car, and then they take the paper mats out of it, and you drive home with it. So I think Volkswagen has understood this for a long time, this whole idea, this sort of experience economy, where this is what it's really about. It's not just about getting the car. It's about the whole experience of buying it and feeling good about it and stuff. And I have to say, one thing that was amazing to me as an American walking through the Autostadt, the sort of theme park, or not more like a museum or exhibition part of it, they had an exhibit called, I don't remember exactly, but it's been a few years, but it was something called There Is No Absolute Safety, which I thought was an amazing concept. And you would actually exit the thing through a smoky tunnel to show you how, you know, things could be kind of scary and the world's not perfect and that you should be careful. Rather than, you need to be protected from everything, but, you know. But then also, Audi, I'm pretty sure a friend of mine here, they built a showroom in Manhattan. Same thing, where the real estate is so insanely expensive that it's not worth, you know, keeping the cars. And I honestly don't know if it's still there. I just didn't have time to check it out.
Yeah.
But right on Park Avenue, and this was 6 or 7 years ago, too, where they had a whole lot of video walls and pretty interesting design and stuff. So I think this is sort of the next evolution, next step in the evolution for that. Whether that'll come down to, you know, the middle of Kansas, I don't know if there's a market to support that kind of stuff. But when you're in a city where there's lots of people with money, or people who can travel there with money, then I think, you know, and they're obviously, I think to us, a lot of this stuff, who see this stuff all the time, it's like, yeah, that's pretty cool. They integrated this and this and this. But I think to, you know, we kind of forget what our audience is sometimes and how blown away people are when they actually see some of this stuff. Because to us, it's like, yeah, well, they just networked this together and blah, 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 blah. But to them, it's really, and the key to that, as always, is good design and good storytelling. And I think when you find that, you know, that's really compelling for a lot of people. So.
Well, George, John raised a good point. You know, in Germany, you'd go to these little, you know, places, and then you could drive over to see your, you know, pick up your car that's spinning on this little carousel. Microsoft and Xbox is moving and making a play to be in every home. They're trying to be not only a gaming system but also a content delivery system. Could it be that, you know, not only in addition to buying CDs and pants and other stuff on Amazon, there could be an app on the Xbox store that lets you interact with your Kinect, build your own car, and buy it from Ford?
Yeah.
Okay, that was not what it. Just yeah. Could I mean is that in theory possible with this?
Well, I think yeah, it is.
Or probable.
And I have to say, Well, I don't know about the holodeck part yet. the three-dimensional, not 3D, but the actual three-dimensional stuff is, I think, a little ways off. But what I found remarkable about this is that, yes, I could go in and find my car. And to counter a little bit to John, I think they'll have at least one physical vehicle in the showroom. You still tactile feel.
Got to sit in
it. Yeah, but you won't have 16 of them unless you have. You think you're going to have that many people coming in to try them all at once. But this is one of the first things that, counter to what I've said many moons ago, that we may very well just be gestures, because this looked really cool, and it was one of the first that I'd go in and say, yeah, I'd go in and check that out. Yeah. I'm not a car person per se, but I would go in and check that and go, well, if I did it like this, oh, that's how it would look. Let me sit down. Okay. And I can envision them doing this with a little sit down, almost like a video game, where you finally get in the car and you have that three-dimensional, or maybe not even three-dimensional, but that, you know, 360 feel of what the car would look around you on screens, that you can actually see what you've created.
Or you could integrate that into Google Street View and say, okay, where do you live?
Yeah.
And let you drive around your own neighborhood with it.
And then, like, the flight simulators, you start to drive it and you know what it's like around your neighborhood. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Would it be complete with fawning neighbors going, ooh, that car?
And their faces would be blurred out, though.
In some cities.
Yeah. Well, you could do that in YouTube. Well, I mean, no, they do that too now.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, my. All right. NC State has an interesting take on the Pico projector, or just projectors in general. North Carolina State University, thanks to Engadget, has developed a new liquid crystal projector. This sucker is 90% efficient. And why that's important is the fact that most LCDs, a lot of the energy is spent, honestly, cooling the sucker down. So, we should actually talk about this in our education show, EdTech. It could be a day where we're not hanging and banging projectors anymore. We are, you know, making sure that, you know, the professors have the latest, greatest iPod or iPhone or, you know, whatever, you know, smartphone device, and, you know, keeping up with the Pico projectors. George, is this, I mean, after reading this article, is this something real, or is it kind of, you know, vaporware that's, you know, in the distance and it's not really going to affect our buddies over at Epson or Sony or Panasonic?
Well, I think it depends on what application you're talking about.
Okay.
Is it real? Yes, I think it's more real than anything I've seen in quite some time for Pico projection. I know at Infocom they were showing what I was calling the macro-micro Pico units that were sort of scaled-down versions of their larger units with pretty decent lumens. But I don't see it replacing it, say, for home theater or for viewing things in a large event. But what it could be really good for, I think, is digital signage and sort of guerrilla marketing, or that I have a really tiny shop. How do I get this interactive projection system to install here? There you go. The resolution may not be extraordinary, but it's probably going to be good enough for the size and the dimensions of the space you're in. And there's a great link, projectorfreak.com. It's a great website. Blog about projection. The guy's crazy about projections and image mapping and projection geometry stuff. And he has a video from a marketing company that shows a car chase a la 70s using Pico projectors down hallways and across desks.
Oh, wow.
And it's really well done. We'll put a link up on it when the show posts. But it's a brilliant use of the Pico projector type hardware. And, you know, we've talked about this in the past briefly, and we know my fear is that, yes, people will get Pico projectors. There's all these great uses, but the annoyance factor and the person insisting that you have to watch the video that they're watching while they're on the train, you know, the loud talkers who need to let everybody know what they're talking about on the cell phone are now going to start showing, you know, family trip stuff or worse, you know, on the walls.
So you always worry about that, and that's not something I've ever even considered, so...
Live in a really large urban city for a while, and you will start to know that as much as you try to avoid it, there's going to be one small group of people that will always insist that you must know what they're doing.
I guess it's the benefits of living St. Louis versus New York. So, John, I think that this does, you know, this would cut into the home theater. But what about stuff like you do with control systems and staging systems or in the classroom?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think it's I don't know. I think it seems more likely to me in the long run. Or I think, I don't know, it all depends. You're sacrificing a lot when you make something that small. And I think it's cool for some, you know, sort of displays, but I can't see this really until they can make something that size that projects, you know, 4K video from 50 feet away. I don't think it's any real competition for anything, but it is sort of interesting. But I don't know. Again, I think this sort of, when you jam all this stuff into a small space, you got to compromise something. So, but and the funny too, because I actually found that if somebody asks me for a projector recommendation these days, I'll tell them to buy a flat screen in most cases.
Really?
Yeah, because you know you don't have problems with sunlight hitting it. You don't have to mount the projector. It's easier to secure the thing. I'm not talking about, there's certainly lots of applications for projectors, but you know, if somebody's asking me, hey, I want a projector for this small thing, then I would just say, you know what, get a big flat screen and you're going to have a lot less problems with it overall.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I went on projection, it's projectionfreak.com. And he has something interesting that kind of relates back to John. He has John's book on there, his brand new book on there. I'm going to take a second here and talk about it. I got my copy in the mail, and it's called Show Networks and Control Systems. And I started reading. Dude, you did a lot of work with this. So, take a second and just kind of tell people, first of all, what the book is and what it's about, and then also where they can get a copy.
Great. Well, thanks for the plug on there. But it's actually the fourth edition. The first edition of the book came out in the mid-90s. I'm sorry, first edition of the book. I think I misspoke there. Mid-90s. And the third edition was 5 or 6 years ago. And those were all published through a publisher, and they decided they didn't want an update. But obviously, with the changes in the control world, I decided to just go ahead and self-publish it myself. So that's been kind of an interesting experiment. I don't even know how to find out what percentage is new, but there's about 30 new pages. I reorganized the whole thing. And the key issue is really to emphasize the networking aspect of it, of the market and what's in the book. I think the first edition in the mid-90s had like 5 or 6 pages on network. The second edition was like 20. The third edition was like 30 or 40. And now it's probably 1/3 of the book now, which is pretty exciting. And lots of stuff in there. That's really just sort of where we're going with this. So I think I broke the key networking parts into 2 chapters. One is sort of like, okay, here's what you need to build a lighting control system today. And then the more advanced topic is more, okay, well now you want to build some of the VLANs and default gateways and routing and stuff like that. That's covered in there in very basic terms compared to the enterprise guys.
Well, and as a testament to that, the first edition of the book was called Control Systems for Live Entertainment.
Right.
And, you know, this one is called Show Networks and Control Systems. So, yeah, I mean, you're right. It is kind of evolved over the last few years.
And one of the great things about sub-publishing is I was literally on the plane back from Infocom, and somebody at Infocom, I mean, all the information in the book is just as relevant to an installation in a museum or whatever as it is to a live concert. But somebody at Infocom had said, hey, yeah, that book looks interesting, but it's not doesn't really cover what I do. And I'm like, oh, well, actually it does. And then I realized on the plane home, I changed the title, literally typed it in on the laptop. And then when I got home, I uploaded it, and that was it.
Wow.
So it's self-publishing has been very interesting with the whole interesting process. That's a whole other topic, but it's been fascinating.
It could be a whole other show. So.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, so not only can people go to your website, I'm assuming to get the book, is that right?
Yes, okay. And right now I'm only selling it on my website. Eventually, probably in the fall, I'll roll it out on Amazon and through some other booksellers, but right now I'm just concentrating it. And to be honest, that's to maximize the royalties so I can recoup the... I hired a copy editor and a cover designer and stuff like that, so I'm trying to maximize the royalties for the initial run. But... yeah, we're going to run the same thing I actually did with Projection Freak. I didn't know you guys were going to talk about his site. It's a great site, though. You definitely should read it. We're going to do a giveaway on my blog. And the way I've been running these is I'll give away copies to the person who can guess a number related to the book as closely as possible. And I think what we've been discussing for this giveaway is the actual word count of the book. So I don't think it is out there. If you wanted to try to count every word, I guess you could do that. But I think it wouldn't be worth the $50 it takes to do that. But yeah, so I'll have a page on my website, and only people who are listening to this podcast will know what the question is. And then they can go to my website, enter their guess, and about a week, I'm trying to get the actual date here on the screen. Whoever gets closest by then, I actually give away two copies to people who get closest.
Oh, very
that
cool.
way people go above and below. And that'll run through July 28th.
Okay. Does that include the index and the glossary and everything?
Yes. I mean, the way I actually calculate it, because I'm not counting it manually, but I actually, it's very hard to count words in a PDF, I discovered, but if you convert the PDF to Word, then you can use Word's Word count feature, and that's what I've done. So. Okay. So if people take a guess at that number.
All right, so go to
It's John's. A lot of words, I can tell you that.
It's a thick book, dude. I mean, you're looking at, you know, what is it, 500 pages almost?
Yeah, 492 pages now. So
yeah, and it's a very cool book. I've actually started reading it already, and it's, you know, some of the stuff doesn't apply because I don't do lighting, but everything else for me, you know, does work, and you know, I have buddies here that do lighting, so... It's a cool book.
Well, I just mentioned one thing. I use lighting a lot in the book as an example because it's a fairly easy to understand, at least conceptually, what you're doing. You're just changing, at least in the conventional system, you're changing levels and stuff. But that's sort of the other thing about the new edition is it's completely restructured now because basically I can't think of a department that doesn't need networking anymore. Maybe the scene painting department doesn't need networking, but certainly audio, video, automated scenery, pyro, that's usually a closed system. Everybody needs to know what an IP address is now, and that's sort of the focus of the book. I mean, it has been the focus of the book since the last edition, but now it's really the main focus of the book.
All right, so John's website is controlgeek.net, controlgeek.net. Go there, and if you don't win the book, buy it, for crying out loud. So
thanks.
All right.
To that end, yes. I have to say, I love this book, and it's one that when I worked at various manufacturers of automation systems and the staging world, I bought it for all of my staff because it was one of those things where they saw the title, John, and I said, no, just read past the title. This is everything right. you thanks. Need to know. Trust me, it'll be there and you'll keep it forever.
Oh, thanks. The check's in the mail.
So. There you go.
Or the PayPal. You can send me the PayPal invoice.
Just buy me a beer. We'll see each other soon enough.
All right. You're listening to AV Week with the aforementioned author and Professor John Huntington, as well as George Tucker from World Stage. I don't want to beat up on our buddies on the West Coast from Anaheim that, you know, their first name starts with E and their last name starts with Tron, but we're going to. There's a story in AV Network. And it talks about how Extron's putting in Meyer Sound into the Ranch Restaurant and Saloon. Extron is putting in Meyer Sound into their restaurant and saloon. I'm confused, George.
Yeah.
Why does my manufacturer have a restaurant and saloon?
Do you have to be drunk to buy? I don't know. I mean, that's sort of the natural... Well, I mean, look, I buy Extron stuff, and don't get me wrong, but...
I do, too.
That's sort of the natural progression, right? Like, oh, come get stuffed and get drunk, and then we'll go take you to the sales side. I don't know. I mean, it's like the early days of AMX when they would take you out every day on training and tell everybody that they had to break the record for the alcohol purchase that night. It's a true story. They would do it every night, every class. So I don't know. Maybe that's going on there, too.
I was going to say, that reminds me of my first Crestron class, but go ahead. I said, that reminds me of my first Crestron class, but go ahead.
Yeah, it wasn't quite. Having done both, trust me.
Okay.
The Texas boys, they'd be drinking. maybe not anymore, but man, was it a free-for-all back then. I don't know. Maybe it's, you know, again, there has to be an attractor, I suppose. Maybe the criticism or the lack of trade show appearances in hearing the criticism say, well, we have to make it a destination point. And if you're going to have a destination point, you might as well make it a lot of fun and something people will be eager to do. I don't know, bring the family, bring more than one representative. I'm not quite sure. But that would certainly fit for me, saying, all right, if I'm going there, at least it's going to be an event and I'm going to have more people around because this is going to happen. It's not just the drudgery of being sold to and maybe a few moments of hands-on. It's a great idea in that sense, though. I mean, hey, here's our stuff. It's all being used here.
Yeah.
And looking at that equipment list, this is not a little tiny couple ceiling speakers. I mean, it's not their biggest line array stuff, but it's pretty serious PA with Galileo processing and all this stuff. So this is like that's the same thing I use to do the Tribeca Film Festival drive-in. It's outdoor with like 20 some speaker systems. So this is like some serious stuff.
Well, yeah, and he's using, you know, a Yamaha digital console, AKG, and Shure microphones, Heil sound microphones for crying out loud. That's, you know, Heil's Bob's from around here. So yeah, I mean, this is, I don't know, it struck me as odd. Not that he's using Meyer, because, you know, obviously Meyer makes pretty good speakers, and everything in this equipment list, like John said, is not exactly, you know, small potatoes. It just struck me as odd with everything else that's happened with Extron in the last 6 months, from, you know, coming out of, you know, removing themselves from both ISE and Infocom, the show, and then this comes down. I was just like, huh?
And are they privately held, Extron?
Yeah. Yeah. Andrew owns it. So,
yeah. Good for them. Yeah. I think it's cool.
Yeah.
I've been to the Google cafeteria here in New York, and it's not as cool as that. So I think that's pretty good bragging rights.
Well, there you go. George helped me out this week a lot because my brain wasn't quite with it. And we haven't done much on patents in the last, you know, 6 to 9 months.
Whee!
And then George comes along and helped me produce this week, and we've got like 10 stories. I'm just giving you a hard time, George. All
well,
right.
They all seem to show up at all
of they
once,
did.
So.
Yes, they did. And it's everything from RIM to Bose to everybody else. So let's just kind of hash through this real quick and you know, take our medicine and talk about, you know.
Can we start with the Dilbert?
Yeah, absolutely, because that's, you know, I love Dilbert.
Go ahead.
But here's the thing. I don't understand patent trolls. I do, because here's a really cool, quick, easy way for me to make money. You know, it's almost like the back in the 90s when we had squatters on websites.
Exactly what I was going to say, yeah.
You know? But, John, is this something that Congress can – the story is from TechDirt, and the question is, can Congress or will Congress, you know, tackle these guys? Is this something that they can do even? Can Congress, you know, will the Constitution or the law allow them to say, you know what, you can't do this?
Will they do anything? I would imagine not. But I think it's, yeah, I think there's the whole patent system is problematic in general, because the basic idea of the patent makes perfect sense, protecting intellectual property and so on. But the way the whole process works has been kind of a disaster for a long time. And we had, in the more sort of live side of the business in the lighting industry, we had a whole bunch of patents granted that, in the basic way patents are not supposed to be granted is if it's it exists in prior art or it's obvious to someone skilled in the trade. But poor patent examiners can't possibly keep up with all these markets. And so it seems to me what they should do is, as soon as the application is filed and then it's protected in some way, they should just put it on the web and let people submit, hey, we did that. Because, in fact, the company I work for, a company that some of the early very light patents that we had done before I worked there in the 70s, we had the things sitting in the warehouse. So it wasn't like, you know, it had been on a tour with Foreigner or somebody. But unless you go sue them, once the patent's granted, you're really screwed. So that's really, I think the trolling, I think there's always going to be trolls in just about anything. But I think that, to me, the bigger issue overall is just the there's too many patents being granted that shouldn't be granted in the first place. I think you solve that problem, then the trolling won't be as much of an issue.
George, John makes a good point. You know, let's start educating our guys and the government employees that are taxed with, you know, doing, you know, saying, researching this stuff. I mean, it's almost like, you know, telling a judge you have to make a ruling on some technology that you've never heard of, and so, you know, you're just going to kind of flip
which,
the coin.
Which they do that all the time.
I know.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the more obtuse examples is that there's a website, James Randi, who's a magician and a skeptic and a mystical debunker kind of guy. And one of the things that he covered a couple of years ago was there was a patent for one of those little, was the iron ferrite bracelets, John, that was supposed to cure or alleviate your arthritis and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
And there was an actual patent for it.
And wait, iron doesn't work. I think it has to be copper.
Or, okay.
I thought it was magnet. Wait a minute. I thought it was magnets.
Oh, magnets. Magnetic copper, yeah. Maybe. That's it.
Does that anyhow, go ahead.
What? We just made a superconductor. But yeah, so, I mean, I agree. It's like there's too much being shot at them, and the definition of what a patent can and cannot cover is too bloody broad. And you will have these patent guys, because, again, like you said, there's money in it. As long as there's money, you're going to have these trolls who will try to buy companies only for the intellectual property that they can go after other companies for. You know, they'll just disembowel them and ship them off to somewhere and say, now we're going to use this information to sue everybody in creation. Monster. But
you have something caught in your throat there.
Yeah, no, sorry. They don't actually do that part, but they go after names. Anyway, you know, it's like, but you're right. Eventually, this has to end. It's like any single-ended business model, like just hanging flat panels for profit. My current recurring theme here is that it'll have to go away because we cannot progress this way for two reasons. One, innovation will stop, and when it stops here, other countries will take it over, and we're just going to be buying intellectual property back.
Oh. Yeah, but I'm pessimistic that any of it's going to change anytime soon because there's just too much money in it. And I just remembered thinking about this when back in the 80s when I was working for a special effects company. We had a guy who patented the idea, not the idea, but the implementation of shooting lasers over the audience and bouncing them off of mirrors, which is pretty obvious to anybody skilled in the trade. And basically, he didn't sign any non-disclosure agreement. So he basically just extorted equipment out of us, gave him a laser, and he went away, and they signed off on it. And then he went after the next bigger company, and that was in 1986 or 7. So, I mean, nothing's changed in that way. There's always going to be scumbags out there. But the bigger issue, I think, that might have some chance of passing, again, is just opening up the patent system a little bit more because it's and I was just at the Hackers on Planet Earth conference over the weekend, and they had a patent attorney actually talk there, which is pretty fascinating. But I don't think any of that's going to go away. But I think the key is just sunlight, getting, you know, get all this stuff as soon as it's filed so that if you have an original idea, it can be protected. Then it should just be on the web, you know, and then anybody can look at it and say, well, you know, we did that 20 years ago. Here's the evidence. And then the patent examiner, there's no way, you know, technology just moves way too fast. The smartest person in the world can't possibly know all these things. So the poor patent examiner is in a horrible situation. So they should crowdsource it, you know.
Wait, and John, you make a good point, and I'll blow through both of these other stories that we had. One is about RIM, one is about Bose. They were in patent fights. Both of them lost. Would that maybe deter companies from even going down the road of, you know, well, you know, ask for forgiveness instead of seeking permission? Or is it going to embolden companies such as Microsoft, which will say, you know what, and Microsoft has done this before, where they'll say, you know what, we're going to use this patent or use this technology, and the company is so small, if they sue us, who cares? You know, we'll either A, pay the fine, or B, we'll just buy them.
Right, and I think that's the whole thing's a moving target. I wouldn't even want to try to predict what's going to happen with that, but just sort of, it's going to just get more complicated. I think that's where it's going to go.
And this is why we don't want them patenting DNA and biological productions, right? Because suddenly someone's going to patent you.
Right.
No, I'd like to see them try.
But then you'd have to sue. Once the patent's granted, you can't. I think there's been like one case in the history of the patent office that they actually retracted. And I can't remember which one that is. It's a pretty famous case because I'm drawing a blank on now. But otherwise, once the thing's granted, the only way to get rid of it is to sue them. And then nobody can do that unless you got tens of thousands or millions of dollars, depending on who you're suing. So it's a really kind of a mess. But again, it's been that way as long as I've been paying attention to it.
Well, look what's happening with all the other stuff. I mean, you can talk about RIM and the other ones blowing through and the Bose, but what's happening in between Crestron and Savant and some others, they're all attacking each other. They're still, you haven't heard some of them in the news, but they're all attacking each other for little bitty things to protect market share, because all of these companies, another part of this is the result of, as the economy expanded and then contracted, everybody was looking for a profit margin using maybe the long tail theory. Of, you know, having 1,000 little niche devices that then worked into an ecosystem. It used to be that, you know, Extron and Crestron could coexist because they really go in each other's realm, and suddenly now they just overlap in a wash of each other.
Right.
Crazy. And of course, you're going to conflict. It's sort of like a super collider. Eventually, you're going to slam into each other because you're both moving so fast and so.
We've had roller derby and super colliders on this show so far. So
that's right.
I think that's a first. All right, let's get me audited by the IRS here. Let's talk about some government stuff. First and foremost is the FBI anti-piracy warning. You know, that wonderful thing that you try to skip through at the beginning of DVDs.
It's so effective. I know every every person who's trying to steal content, as soon as they see that, they just turn it off and hide the thing immediately.
Never so. Mind.
And they go, who's pimply? They little tighten up and they go, nah, I can't do this. You're right.
But I guess anybody can download it now, so maybe I'll just make a T-shirt or something.
Well, that's the thing. That's the story is that now
we... And then sell it.
Yeah. We could do it. We could put it on our stuff. I mean, that's the thing is, you know... I mean, is this...
It's like the parental advisory sticker that turned into T-shirts and everything else that people wanted just for the advisory because it made you hip.
Sorry, but I think I actually cut you off before you had explained what it was. Sorry.
No, you're right, though. It doesn't. And that was the thing is guys like, well, AV Nation, we could put it on ours just to, you know, anybody that really has anything to copyright, the FBI is making it available for more than just DVDs and CDs. You can put it on anything. I mean, you could put it on a website, John. You could put it on your book.
Nah, that's it. That'll stop them.
You should. That'll stop the teacher in Wisconsin from putting it on the Xerox machine. So.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, I'm afraid I'm with John here on this, George. I mean, it doesn't really stop anything, does it?
No, not really. And by the way, Xerox is a trademark name,
Thank
not a
you.
Thank you. Thank you for my writer magazines back in the day. You know, they would have thousands of those ads saying, you know, Kleenex is a product, not a process. You know, but you know what the first thought I had when I saw this was, and it's a little obtuse, surprise. But the first thing, there's a Yakov Smirnoff. You remember him, the comedian from the 80s?
He's in Branson now.
Is he what?
He's in Branson now, but go ahead.
Oh, yeah. He's got his own theater, I think.
Yes, he does.
He had a joke that used to go, you know, there are two TV stations in Russia. Channel 1 is Russian government TV. Channel 2 is KBG going, go back to Channel 1. You know, how effective was that really? I mean, come on, you know.
Oh, no,
hoist me petard. You just made a fool of yourself.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, and on that, you know, no, let's go ahead and continue with the government stories just because, you know, I haven't been audited yet. So the DARPA is, if you don't know what that is, it is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. In other words, it's your tax dollars at work creating machines that will one day, you know, put us all into subservience, has created a machine that will put out fires with sound. George, this comes to me from a kid who remembers fondly stories of Manuel Noriega's arrest in Panama, where they used to blast, was it Black Sabbath or Aerosmith?
Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember. One of those, yeah.
Where, I mean, this is, I don't know, this is getting a bit too sci-fi for me.
Well, I mean, what was the, John, you might remember this too, the Dark Science, is it on the Science Channel? They have a whole series of shows about, like, science gone wrong and used for bad things. And one of them was about the two guys in Germany that discovered that low-frequency sounds caused people to be ill and you couldn't stay in the room. And that's developed into the sonic weapons that use to disperse rioters and stuff.
Yeah.
It's sort of the same thing. Sorry, something just went off in my head there. I'm wearing headphones and my email just popped up, like three or four emails just popped up, and I had this audible going on. The voices in my head are saying, this is not really a surprise. I mean, this is something that would want to expect. And didn't the Mythbusters do something about this, about blowing out a candle?
Yeah, I think so.
They did.
Yeah, but I think this is a lot more... I read this quickly, but they're talking in here that it's the sound increases air velocity, which then thins the area of the flame, which the combustion occurs. So that's known as the flame boundary. So this is a lot different. I mean, it's certainly an interesting idea, but unless you come in with your 18-foot subwoofers on either side of the fire, and I'm not sure what this is going to do. But it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I'm sure we're not going to see houses or forest fires put out with this. But isn't there? I can't think of it at the moment, but I'm suspecting there might be some industrial usage for this in some process. I just can't think of what that would be. But I'm sure somewhere along the line you're going to hear about a manufacturer who uses this technique to do something. Maybe quickly cool something that was molded and melted and formed. I don't know.
Mm, yeah, okay. So not, not nefarious, but an actual practical use.
Yeah.
And a couple of tangents to this. One was back in the 80s, I was working for the special effects company. We actually did a project for the Navy, which was an air cannon, which is about 8 feet long, that would shoot fire retardant material out. And the idea was you're on the deck of an aircraft carrier and something goes wrong. You just hit this cannon and it would blow all this stuff all over the deck. It was pretty fun to work on it. And we were shooting it at a berm out behind the building. And we had the elevation wrong, and we shot the thing, and the flour, like bag of flour, like shot over the berm and like landed about half a mile away. Fortunately, there wasn't a road back there or anything. But more on topic, there was also at the Hacker Conference this weekend, and all this stuff will be online. It's at hope.net eventually. But it was a big controversy because DARPA is also sponsoring the Maker Fair now.
Really?
Yeah. And so Mitch Altman was a pretty well-known hacker. He's like taught 10,000 people to solder. Like he was there. He goes to all these shows. And he's been at the Maker Fair, I think, since the first or second one. And he's now publicly withdrawn from that because of the DARPA involvement. So I don't know if I agree with him, because, I mean, also DARPA funded the development of the internet and things like that. So it's kind of an interesting thing. But it does show you where the money's spread out all over the place.
Well, and actually, John, one more story we have about the government is the fact that the CIA is funding a lot of technology. So, you know, all kidding aside and my libertarian views aside, the government does fund some pretty cool things. You mentioned the fact that DARPA funded the internet, at least. So without that and without that foresight, we wouldn't have, well, you guys wouldn't be talking to me currently, and we wouldn't be doing this show.
Not in this way, at least.
I'd have to have an ISD in line, so...
That's right.
Probably two of them.
Yes, two. Well, that's it. Yeah, because you guys are in separate locations. So yeah, I'd have to have two of them. So
not that I'm not old enough to know anything about that. No.
Well, dude, I do. I mean, when I was my first job in radio was at KMOX, and we had a bank of ISDN lines because KMOX was the main station for the Cardinals and the Blues at the time. And not only did we have an ISDN connection between, let's say that. The Jack Buck and Mike Shannon were in Chicago for a series of games, so we had an ISDN line coming from Chicago to us, and then we took it and did whatever it was that we did, which was insert network commercials, and so that signal went to another ISDN, which connected us to, I want to say, Columbia, Missouri, and from Columbia, Missouri, that was our uplink to the satellite. So yeah, you're right, we had two ISDNs. Holy cow. Not that we needed to get off on ISDN. Sorry. All right, you're listening to AV Week with John Huntington and George Tucker. One last story, and it comes to us from the buddies, our guys over at Gizmodo. The question is this, and George, we'll start with you. Do you want a smaller iPad?
And yes.
You do. Why?
Yes, because I think the other one is too large and too clunky. It's not something that
clunky?
I would be...
Have you had one?
Well, wait. Yes, I have. Okay. But the reason I say clunky, and I'm going to sort of quantify that, that for me, it's about accessing information and quickly reviewing stuff, maybe typing up a document, but I find it harder. I need a physical keyboard personally. But for someone like me who doesn't want the doesn't want to do it on the phone, but I'm not really using it to view my own media or stuff as a primary source, this smaller unit is more like a remote, more handy for me, and it can fit in my pocket without having to carry a satchel.
Okay. John, do you want a smaller iPad?
No, because I already have two Android tablets and an Android phone, and I actually have all three sizes already that I could want. I have a phone, I have a Kindle Fire, and then I have a Samsung Galaxy, whatever, a 10-inch thing I use for storm chasing. So, I think... There's people just obsessed on this one, you're talking about like Kleenex brand tissue. You're talking about the Apple brand tablet. But I think that's they make such a big deal over it. But these things already exist from plenty of other people out there. They're running Android.
And see, I would take issue with George's take. I'm with you, John. I have an Android app, an Android phone. I have a Nexus, a Samsung Nexus. And yeah. I love it. It works great. It works for what George is talking about for that form factor. But I also have an iPad because when it comes to things like content consumption, even a little bit of content creation, because I've gotten used to typing on it. It's my Facebook app. It's what I primarily use to that's what I get on Facebook with. It's what I primarily do email with. my kids absolutely love it, and sometimes it's somewhat difficult to, you know, to pry it out of their hands. And yeah, for a remote, I can see where it would be a little bit clunky and a little bit big for that. But my thing is that this is a content consumption slash quasi creation device, especially when you pair it up with an Apple TV and you have AirPlay. The other day we've been making some videos this week and with some, for some family stuff, and I got a couple emails this week and we all wanted to kind of view it, and instead of having everybody look over my shoulder on the iPad, simply walked into the living room, brought up the YouTube link on my iPad and hit AirPlay, and all of us could watch it on the big screen. It was absolutely phenomenal. I mean, it was just one more reason why I really love and kind of gotten sold out to the iPad experience, especially when you marry it to the Apple TV and the whole AirPlay thing. So I think it's fine.
Yeah, but how does size matter if you're going to use AirPlay? Doesn't matter, does it? The resolution is not going to change, is it?
It doesn't. It does. I will concede to that. It doesn't. But it's everything else that I do with it. You know, I've gotten to the point where I really can't do email or Facebook or some other things, or the games on my phone anymore. My phone is primarily, you know, my phone with some, you know, texting and stuff like that, and some other, you know, silly little, you know, things that I do on my phone. But primarily, you know, my iPad is everything else. So
this and we may not have time for this, but no, this leads right into that other story about Wozniak's backpack.
Jeez, so John, I was hoping not to mention
John,
that one. Go ahead.
John, how many devices do you carry with you all day long?
Well, yeah, and I was comparing that because when I was out this May, I was out storm chasing, and I had to buy a camera bag, and I was kind of comparing it to that, and I was like, man, I'm traveling heavy, and I looked at his thing, and I was like, he's got 75% more stuff than I do. So, yeah, it's crazy. Okay. And I should explain to people what it is, because I don't know.
First of all, Steve Wozniak is the Uber geek, okay? And if you don't know who Steve is, Steve was the other half of Apple back in the 70s when Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak actually started the company. But George, go ahead. That was, you know, yes, he had a lot of stuff.
Yeah, well, the article basically details, it's a Gizmodo article, I believe, that details what's in Wozniak's backpack. And he has it all fleshed out at some studio he was at doing an interview. And it was 50 pounds of stuff that he carries yeah. all the time. It was like two iPads, two phones, this, a couple of smartwatches,
all counting,
the chargers.
I think there's nine phones.
Okay.
Why? Why? Who needs nine phones? Seriously. Who needs two iPads?
Well, I'm sure what happens, and from what I could read between the lines, he was using each for a specific set of tasks that he found most comfortable on those.
Yeah.
And while this is a little extreme, and, you know, Wozniak's just a little out there, and of course he's always on the edge in many different respects, he does show us that, the mobile revolution really hasn't solved much, at least for those who are heavy, heavy users. Even when you watch the guys on Twitter, they go, oh yeah, I have with me my iPad. Oh yeah, no, I have my iPhone with me. Oh no, I have my iThing with me. You know, it doesn't have enough room on the iPhone, so I have my iPod for my, you know, 500 gigs of music. So you're carrying around 16 things. I mean, we're back to the days with the Walkmans where they made, remember those cargo pants they made that were specific for
yep.
your electronic devices that would hide them inside, and you'd carry everything around with you that didn't look like you were having it all on your belt like a military guy?
Yeah,
but
here's the thing. I mean, Woz is a super user. I mean, he has a Kindle and an iPad. My Kindle app is on my iPad. That's why I bought the iPad. It was because I didn't like the form factor of the Kindle, honestly. I mean, and I'm in grad school, and so I'll be very frank. That Kindle, the Kindle app on the iPad was $500. I'll bet you I've saved every bit of $200 to $250 buying my graduate school books on Amazon's website, on the Kindle store, and reading them on the iPad. So I'm not going to say it paid for itself, but it halved it at least. So,
well, I think the most interesting thing in his backpack, which they don't really explore, but he talked about his $2 bill pads in there, and he actually keep talking about the Hope conference that just wrapped up. But Wozniak spoke there 4 years ago, I think, and you can find the talk online. But he, I actually thought it was $20 bills, but I guess it's $2 bills. You can buy uncut sheets of $2 bills that are legal. They cost a lot more than $2 times the number of bills there. And then he sends, if I'm remembering right, he sends them out and gets them perforated, and then bound into a pad, so that these are actually legal tender, but no one's ever seen one. So, and worse than that, he'll come in and go, "Oh, that's $8," and he'll rip four of these off, rip, and then hand them to the people just to freak them out. And wow. It's totally, so he's actually spending more than $2 per $2 bill just for the joke. But if I can dig up the link on that talk, I'll find it, because it's hilarious that he that talks awesome. This whole thing.
You gotta love Woz. I mean, just
Woz.
All right. Well, you have been listening to AV Week. If you've made it to this point, thank you very much for sticking with us. With us has been the professor extraordinaire and author and Yale graduate, the professor of entertainment technology at the New York City College of Technology, Mr. John Huntington. Tell people how they can get a hold of you, follow you, and get your book, of course.
You can do all those things at controlgeek.net.
Controlgeek.net. Why did you want? Would you like to publicize your Twitter handle there, sir?
I think it's you can actually it's embedded on Control Geek, but okay, I believe perfect. It's just Jay Huntington.
Okay. Also with us is George Tucker. He is the engineering coordinator for World Stage, and one of my right hand guys here at the old AV Nation. Tell people how they can find your blog and your Twitter and all that jazz.
I blog for Rave, so you can find that on Rave Pub Edge at tuckertuesday.typepad.com, and I occasionally do it for the AV Shout.
Very cool. Yeah, I saw that. What was it? Was it Team Red?
Yeah, Team Red. He's calling it Red Band. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. And my name is Tim Albright. If you would like to follow me and my ramblings, it is T, D as in David, Albright, A-L-B-R-I-G-H-T on Twitter. TD Albright, but more importantly for me and for everybody here at AV Nation, go by the website. It is avnation.tv, avnation.tv. You can find blogs. You can find information about each of us and what we do. You can also find a link to where you can find the podcast, and that is at our partner site, ravepubs.com/AVNation, ravepubs.com/AVNation. Go there and check out all the other podcasts we have. We have one about DIY. Education. We recorded one this morning about the women in AV, so all sorts of really cool things. And we have a daily one we do with Gary Kay called The Daily Rave. Ravepubs.com/AV Nation. That's all the time we have for AV Week.